website, its webpage is pretty beautifully designed, and it's got this nice story where you started off. And I couldn't remember the name of the town, but I couldn't tell you what the story was. But so you've got to see the webpage.
That's some great prep.
No, so my name Mark's academic bio. He was an undergraduate at Cambridge and then was a graduate in Brown. Going to MIT and Case Western. So then he went to our surveys and been there ever since. So he'll be telling us today about dark energy and modified gravity.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'll make sure to stay on.
Thanks for inviting me. It's nice to be here, and it's also nice to see so many people I know from various places, like Slava, I read you from when I was a graduate student at Yale and Syracuse. So this is a colloquium, so it's I've tried to sketch a path through the things I want to talk about here, but I'm around the rest of the day, so if anyone wants to talk more in detail, I'm here. But we can chat. So before I get going, I'm going to give some acknowledgments. So I've been working with a lot of great people over the last few years. Is that still loud enough for people back there? Okay. So some of them at Syracuse and elsewhere, including a lot of graduate students, red here, excellent postdocs in blue, faculty members, undergrads. There have been a lot of people I've worked with, and I wanted to acknowledge them here and also acknowledge my funding. So I'm going to give a very brief overview of the universe observed. You'll have seen this part of the talk many times, so bear with me, but it's worthwhile at least putting us all in the same place before I talk about the main part of the talk. So I'll cover the cosmological constant, the coincidence problems, dark energy, quintessence, etc., just as to summarize the attempts that people have made to address the accelerating universe. And then I want to get on to the question of, could it be that some of our observations are revealing new secrets about gravity? Are we learning something about gravity by some of the strange things we've been seeing in cosmology in recent years? And the main point of what I want to talk about today is actually how difficult it is to make a program like that work. So, you know, I want to talk about how, when you modify gravity, some of the problems you come up with, some of the constraints you hit. It seems, on the face of it, easy to modify gravity in a way that gives you cosmic acceleration. But as we'll see, you tend to hit the problem whichever direction you go. And so a lot of the talk will be giving you examples of the kind of problems you hit when you modify gravity. And then towards the end, I'll take the attitude, well, OK, let's just take one or two of these models, not worry about those small-scale problems, treat them as infrared modifications of gravity, and try to ask, what kind of generic predictions would you get of a modification to gravity when you're looking at structure formation in the universe, et cetera? How might you distinguish modified gravity from something like dark energy, for example? And I'll summarize at the end, because I've always found that to be the best place for summary. So you don't need to be told in great detail about what's gone on in cosmology in recent years. Let me just go through it. So observational cosmology has undergone this amazing story where the accumulation of evidence from lensing surveys, rotational velocities of galaxies, white curves of type 1A supernovae, microwave background, including these wonderful recent results from the third year, fourth year, however many years, WMAP data, and older evidence like the abundances of light elements, and these are just a sample of things, have led to this picture that you often hear described where the energy contents of the universe are summarized in this pie chart, which you see where 4% of the universe is chemistry, 22% of the universe or so is dark matter, some kind of clustering component that does not undergo the electromagnetic interaction. And 74% is interpreted as being dark energy, which I'll say more about soon. And most of what I want to talk about in this talk is, should we trust this particular conclusion? So what is it about cosmic acceleration? So here's a Hubble plot using crazy astronomers' units. So redshift and effective magnitude. And what you see from this is not only is the universe expanding, which was no secret to anyone, but it's accelerating. So here are fits. These are data points from supernovae at increasingly high redshift. And here are a variety of curves, some fitting flat cosmologies, omega matter and omega lambda, some open cosmologies among just the CDM cosmology. And by far the best fit to this data from these models is the one in which the universe is flat and has a significant component of dark energy. In this case, this particular fit, it's just a cosmological constant. Okay? So the universe seems to be accelerating, a double dot, is positive, okay? And these supernovae are quite remarkable. If you've ever seen this video, some people show this in a number of talks, but it's kind of amazing. So if you just watch that galaxy for a moment, this is just one star, and this is a type 1a supernovae going off. If I can figure out how to play it one more time. Okay, there you go. And it's as bright as the entire host galaxy at the time that it's going off. It's a remarkable thing. And what's more remarkable is that people have figured out how to use these as standardizable candles, and now these are maybe not our best evidence for acceleration, but certainly our most direct evidence for acceleration. So to a cosmologist, if you're not interested in how matter clusters, if you're only interested in the background evolution of the universe, general relativity is a relatively easy thing to do. You just write down the simplest possible metric you can think of, one which respects homogeneity and isotropy, spatial homogeneity and isotropy, and all you have to play with is the scale factor A of t that tells you how quickly things are moving apart, and the Einstein equation is reduced to the Friedmann equation, which tells you that the Hubble parameter squared is determined by the amount of energy density in the universe. I've omitted the curvature here. I'm going to treat that as not there for the rest of the talk. And the acceleration equation, which tells you how A double dot depends on combination of the energy density and pressure of the various components of the energy budget of the universe. And cosmologists like to parameterize different types of matter by equations of state parameters, W. So if you have the ith type of matter has a relationship pi is wi rho I. And then if the evolution happens to be dominated by type I, with W a constant, then you can derive these nice solutions for the scale factor and the energy density as it redshifts away. Now, in this context, if you ask the question, what does cosmic acceleration mean, then you look back to the acceleration equation and you see that putting in p equals w rho, the only way you'll get acceleration is if the universe is dominated by a type of matter for which the equation of state parameter w is less than minus a third. Okay? And if that's the case, there are three broad possibilities for what that could be. And by possibilities, I really just mean what's allowed by the data. Okay? So you could have W between minus a third and minus one. If that's the case, then you have the evolution of the energy density of whatever is driving this acceleration redshifts away, but it does so in such a way that it redshifts more slowly than any regular matter in the universe. So if you wait long enough, if you arrange it correctly, long enough means today, then the dominant thing in the universe will be this dark energy, and it will start to accelerate the universe. And the evolution of the scale factor in the far future of models like this is what you might call power law quintessence. The universe has a scale factor that goes like t to the p with p bigger than 1. Okay? If w is minus 1, this is just a cosmological constant, and meaning it does not vary in space or time. And the scale factor asymptotically will approach exponential expansion. There is the possibility within this parameterization that w is less than minus 1. And if that's the case, then this is a truly bizarre type of matter, because as the universe expands, and you would think it would dilute things that were in it, the energy density will increase with the expansion. And if you really have such a capped fluid with W less than minus one constant, then actually the scale factor will blow up in a finite time. This is what is sometimes referred to as the big rip. So I'm not going to advocate that as a way the universe works, but it's a logical possibility at the level of this parameterization. I'll say a little bit more about this later, though. So given this way of talking about it, what are the logical possibilities for what's causing acceleration? Well, if this is the Einstein equation, then one possibility, as I just mentioned, is to have completely new mass energy sources. Okay? So quintessence, k-essence, oscillating dark energy, put some new form of mass energy on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation and make that behave in such a way as to cause late-time acceleration. And this is an idea that many, many people have worked on, of course. Here's just a smattering of names that I pulled off the top of my head. And basically, every cosmologist and most particle physicist you can think of have tried to play with this idea at one time or another. Plenty of people in this room have already done it. On the other side, you could take the attitude that when you see something very strange happening in the universe, like late-time acceleration, then it's not the right-hand side of the Einstein equation that's the problem. It's the left-hand side. It could be that the way in which space-time responds to regular old matter and energy density in the universe is not what you thought it was. And maybe a modification of gravity is happening in the infrared, large distances. And so people have pursued this in a variety of different ways. I'll say more about this letter. And here again is just a random smattering of names that I pull off the top of my head, suitably edited to make sure that I hopefully didn't insult anyone in the room. And then there's the other. Okay? Now, other here, I don't mean doesn't necessarily fit into either of these sides. This means I don't really know how to categorize it. One example of this might be the cosmological constant, whether you think of it as a fundamental bare constant of nature or some mass energy source. But
sorry,
think.
I could ask a really, really stupid question here, but is it safe to assume that Cardassian Moles is not necessarily named after the race from Star Trek?
It is not safe to assume that.
Ah!
This would be a good point for me to point out that I am not responsible for that.
People complain about the names I use in my face.
This could be the worst one of all. No, it's named that way, and it's named that way for a reason, I am told. So, the other here, another example, extra dimensions, I put this in here because, in a sense, you could imagine in the full dimensional theory, what you're dealing with is a modification of the energy momentum tensor, but in the effective four dimensional theory, maybe it's more like Newton constant or something like that. Just depends how you look at it. Back reaction, do we fully understand how perturbations, when correctly taken into account, influence the global nature of space-time, and environmental selection, which was a way to avoid saying the anthropic principle, which I've already said now. So many, many, many people have worked on this, and many more, and I won't say much about that at all in this talk. Okay, so this is the kind of space of ideas you could try to play with. For me, the biggest question, before we get into any of this, is what's driving cosmic acceleration, a cosmological constant or not? Now, many people like to sprinkle, you know, quotes from Shakespeare and other such things into their talks to show how erudite they are. I like to use Arnold Schwarzenegger movies. And I think the cosmological constant, really, is like the predator. Okay, so the cosmological constant, he's not Cardassian, that's bad. So the problem here is that, you know, you have something that it's very, very hard to make out what you're looking for. You would love to find a way to nail down the properties of what you're looking at. Okay? If you have a cosmological constant, you will not be able to do this at any level of any level you would want. It will not cluster in space. It will not cluster in time. You will measure what it is, and then you're done. And that makes it an extremely challenging problem for experimental physics. Whereas if it's anything else, modified gravity, dark energy, something that has dynamics, then in the immortal words of Arnold Schwarzenegger, if it bleeds, we can kill it. We can figure out what it is. We can figure out what is the dark energy. It's a very deep man. So this is a big question. So actually, what this means is that for observations, what you should really care about is, you know, can you measure if there's any clustering, if there's any time evolution, if W is not minus one today, any of those things, and they don't all have to happen, just one of them is enough to tell you whether you have a cosmological constant. That would be a big deal for connecting this data to fundamental physics. Okay.
Sort of a terminological question only, but why don't you include lambda as a modification of gravity?
So as I said, I didn't, things in the middle there are not meant to say, you couldn't argue they go on either of those sides. It's just, I didn't quite know how to categorize it, so I just put it. Yeah, no, it wasn't supposed to be a rigid taxonomy. So what does the data tell you? So if you take the data that I talked about for a while, the supernovae data, and you plot that against actually omega matter, so you don't have to worry too much about this axis on these plots, and you combine it with limits from the 2-degree field galaxy redshift survey, and limits from the microwave background from WMAP on these graphs, then you end up with likelihood contours that look like this. So what you see is that W has a central value extremely close to minus one, annoyingly so. But there is room for quite a variation here, both above and below the minus one boundary. Okay, I'm not putting any theoretical cuts on this and the fact that you might not like W less than minus one. This is what the data allows. So I show this, you already knew this, but I show it because I want to make a point in a few seconds that you know, we'll come back to discuss what's really being measured here, because it's important to realize what it is that the data is telling you.
So
But it's one sigma usual.
So here, one sigma, two sigma, three sigma.
Two sigma. But why you if you use that you minus 0.3 for the
I'm sorry, say that again?
You see, if you take that this is one sigma, then you cannot go the, so it's, you see, Dow, you went nearly to minus 1.5.
Yep.
As a root of one sigma, right?
Yep.
So systematic 0.1 and minus 0.3 should be a little bit up.
Yes, it should be a little bit up. This number's not quite accurate. Yeah. This is right, I think I've just written the wrong number. Thank you.
So this is right. It's even less specific. I mean, the picture is right.
I believe the picture is right. Yeah, the picture is right. Yeah. Okay. So let me just say one thing about the cosmological constant. So this slide is, in a sense, a little simplistic. I'm going to mention Susie on this slide, and I'm not going to worry about supergravity or brain models or anything like that. But one thing about the cosmological constant to point out is that although it's going to be very hard to figure out if we have a cosmological constant by doing our cosmological observations, there is something very important that collider physics can tell us, which is the following. If you turn on the LHC and you maybe build an ILC and you figure out that you found new physics and it falls into supermultiplets, that you're very confident that you have a theory that is supersymmetric, then what you'll find out is that since in a supersymmetric state, you would have no vacuum energy, I'm ignoring the supergravity, well, we could have that discussion as well if you like, then the only vacuum energy in these theories really comes from Suzy breaking, and the question of what sets the cosmological constant, that's what you think is driving your acceleration, comes down to the question of what breaks Suzy. So I include this just as a slide to say that if it is a cosmological constant, it could mean something very profound for our particle physics theories, and colliders may tell us something about that. Okay, you might have to understand what breaks supersymmetry may be the answer to understanding the cosmological constant. It would have to be very subtle, because it certainly may be naive estimates put you off by 60 orders of magnitude. Okay, so let me just skim through other possibilities. Let me talk about quintessence. So quintessence, dark energy, the idea here is that suppose that the vacuum energy is zero. There's no cosmological constant. This would be of interest either if you could find a good reason for the cosmological constant to be zero, or if measurements showed you that dark energy varied in space or time. Because if it does, then the cosmological constant problem would still be an interesting one, but it would not be one that you'll be forced to address by cosmological data. So you could then start to investigate these models. So here you'd like something like late time inflation. Scalar field rolls down a potential. You don't need this to end in the way that regular inflation ends, so it can run off to infinity. If you write down Lagrangian, the energy density for such a field, then if you have it slowly rolling, the equation of state parameter will be dominated by the potential terms, and you'll have a W less than minus a third. This can lead to late time acceleration. Like,
yeah, just a dumb question. Is there any particular reason it's not rolling the other way?
No.
It also be rolling that field.
Yeah. I don't think I care about the field, absolute value of the field values or anything. It just matters that it be able to run off forever. Yeah. So let me go back to this question. When I showed you the data on W, I showed you that W could be less than minus 1, could be greater than minus 1, could be minus 1. I also commented earlier that, for example, if W is less than minus 1, that would really make you worry because you would have some very weird stuff which had an energy density that increased as the universe expanded. Now, if you try to make a sensible particle theory out of that, by the way, it will go horribly wrong. It will be unstable. All kinds of horrible things will happen. On the other hand, if you look at what you're really measuring when you measure the equation of state parameter, this is what you're doing. You're actually doing an integral over this, but I don't really care about that for my purposes here. So all I've done here is taken the Einstein equations, put in something with an equation of state W, and inverted those equations for W. So this is what you get. So I've assumed a flat universe, so that's why I only have omega matter in here. So the equation of state parameter is minus 1 over 1 minus omega matter, is related to h dot and h squared, where h dot and h squared are the things that your Hubble plot tells you. Now, if you have regular general relativity, you know for a fact that if you measure this to be less than minus 1 to significant accuracy, you have discovered something truly bizarre about the type of energy momentum that is causing the universe to accelerate. On the other hand, if you don't have general relativity on large scales, this is a perfectly fine thing to plot, but what you're plotting is just some function. You've divorced W as something that describes the microphysical properties of some energy momentum component from the expansion rate. So if gravity is modified, you can infer a value for W that's not directly related to the equation of state parameter of whatever's in your universe. So just this is, I think, a very important point in principle, that you have to be careful how you interpret data from cosmology for fundamental physics. And just to give an example, which is absolutely not supposed to be selling you a model of how the world works, but if you took a Brans-Dicke theory, so here's the Brans-Dicke Lagrangian, I've written it down because I want to use it later as well. So you've got some scalar coupled to gravity. I've put in a potential. So that's one sense in which it's just formally different from what people mean when they say Brans-Dicke. Choose this parameter omega to be greater than 40,000. That's mandated by solar system tests, most recently from the Cassini mission, from timing signals from Cassini. Then what we were able to show with my former student, Antonio De Felice and John Carroll, was that with difficulty, you can tune this potential, and I don't care about the tuning here, it's to make a point, that you have energy, dark energy in the universe that has absolutely no sicknesses. It doesn't, its energy density does not increase as the universe expands. It is not a sick quantum theory, and yet you would infer a W less than minus one. So I think actually I'm going to skip this slide because it's not very clear. But this, well, the point is here, this W that you measure as a function of various constraints. So it's a function of the gradient of the potential and this bound on the time variation of the Hubble constant, of the Newton constant. Because in a Brans-Dicke theory, you have to make sure that the Newton's constant does not change too quickly. So you can satisfy all those observational constraints, infer W less than minus one from the data, and have absolutely no problem with any of the theory. So this is just a point that one needs to be careful how to interpret the data. Now, if you're going to think about problems like that, you might as well ask the question, maybe it's all gravity, as I said earlier on. Okay? So as we know, there's a precursor to this. This has happened before. Le Verrier had proposed that, in fact, the advance of the perihelion of Mercury was due not to some modification of gravity, but some new mass energy, namely another planet on the other side of the sun. And we know, in fact, that what actually happened was you had to modify gravity. Okay? Now, you should be aware, as soon as anyone tries to appeal to Einstein's authority or experience, he's going to start messing around with relativity in hopes that this will discard it. So, how would you do this? Well, if you want to modify gravity, there are some things that actually spring to mind pretty quickly. First of all, you'd like to write down Lagrangian that involves the metric, g mu nu. You'd like, and its derivatives. You don't want to abandon general covariance. You might not want to. I simply didn't want to. And if you ask what are the propagating degrees of freedom in the metric, well, in principle, there is a spin 2 piece. There's a scalar piece. It's a vector piece. Now, you never talk about those in general relativity, and there's a good reason for that, and that's that the Einstein-Hilbert action is extremely special. And the Einstein-Hilbert action yields equation of motion that constrain away these extra degrees of freedom. They're non-propagating. The only thing that's left is spin 2 piece, which is the graviton. Okay. That's fine. But almost anything else you do to the action for gravity will free up new degrees of freedom. Now, in a sense, that's great. Yeah?
You said that you want to keep general covariance.
Yeah.
In your scalars and vectors. In addition to g mu nu. That would spoil the general covariance.
Why will that spoil the general covariance?
Well, it would keep general covariance if you ignore self-gravity.
I don't want to give these a bath. I'm allowed to write down electromagnetism, right?
So these scalars and vectors are representing gravity as well, or is something else?
They're already there in g mu nu, right?
Oh, I see.
Right? Yeah. So, now, having new degrees of freedom is not a bad thing. I mean, you want something strange to happen at late times to the universe. And so these degrees of freedom give you a way to do that. But you have to be aware because they can also screw up your theory. And as we're going to see, this is typically what happens when you stop modifying gravity. So two things in general happen. I'll give you examples of theories in which both these things happen. One thing is that you can just ruin solar system tests. Okay, and we'll see this kind of a general reason that this often happens. Okay, so I mentioned already that there are great tests of GR in the solar system, for example, from this Cassini mission. And as we'll see, some things, some modifications just hit against that immediately. Second, you can have theories where this is not an issue at all, and yet you end up with ghost-like degrees of freedom. So some of these new degrees of freedom become ghost-like, and that makes the theory sick. Now, you might take the attitude that, well, if I have ghosts and they become, those ghosts are only important above a certain scale, then I'll treat this as an effective theory, and once the theory becomes strongly coupled, I'll replace it with something well-behaved. You can do that, and we haven't done that. I don't see how to do that in any sensible way to these theories. I consider this a sickness. Like,
yeah, I mean, there's another way to say it, that the positive energy theorem for asymptotic space times is lost. It's not just that there are sort of some propagating ghosts, it's that the stability of flat space time as a solution is lost.
Well, I'm not sure that's the same thing, because in these theories, I actually want to forbid flat space being a solution. I don't want it to be a stable solution.
Okay, so it may not be the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, for example, and we should maybe talk about this a little bit later, but general relativity with a cosmological constant is also does not have flat space as a solution.
No,
no,
we should
sure. Right, so in that, so that might be another, I don't know, that might be another problem, but I don't think it's the same as the thing. I don't think the ghost is symptomatic of that.
But if you turn off the cosmological constant and you have ghosts, then they tend to remain, and then you can show that at the linearized level you lose positive energy, and then you tend to lose it at the full level as well, because I know no case in which they don't. I mean, there were many, you know.
Yeah, so, good, so there'll be a question whether you can take the limit of turning off this new things I'm going to add. I guess, right, so good. So we'll I can come back to that.
I think these are actually related, because when you say decay of the vacuum, like some times, that's related to a positive energy. If you had a good positive energy theorem, that would usually block something like that.
It might be related to a positive energy condition. It could be. Not sure. Okay, so let me give a very simple example. So suppose that you take the Einstein-Hilbert action and you just make the action a function of the Ricci scale. Right? So this seems a fairly innocuous thing to do, although the types of functions you might need to make cosmic acceleration work will turn out to be very ugly. So here's an example. You could take the Einstein-Hilbert term and add to it an inverse term in the Ricci scale. Now, why would you do something so hideous to the Einstein-Hilbert action? Well, you would do something like this because you would like to forbid Minkowski space from being a solution. And you would do, so here r equals 0 will not be a solution. And then you can ask, what kind of spaces will the universe approach when matter dilates away? So I'll focus on n equals 1 just to give an example. So here's the equation of motion you get. It's a mess. It has its high derivative, it's a complete mess, and I can start to, so I'll say a lot more about this in a moment, let me just write it down. And for cosmology, you'd like to put regular old fluids on the right-hand side, namely matter, no dark energy, okay, I don't want that, just regular matter. So really pressureless matter, we think of
carefully. Yeah. Why have the R term there at all? Because it looks like you still get an R mu. Why just have one over R?
Because I'm going to have two scales in this problem, I need to use mu as a scale that is distinct from the Planck mass. I need to have a scale in here which will cause acceleration to kick in at the right scale. And so mu will be dramatically small. Mu is a cosmological constant. It's right. So roughly speaking, what you'd like to do here is have a term that is such that nowhere in the history of the universe has the curvature been small enough to see this term until today, when everything's dilated away, even on cosmological scales, enough. OK, okay, so how does this work? So you could take that equation I just put down and look for the constant curvature vacuum solutions, and you'd find that the set of specs in the solution. And that's kind of nice because it means that you might have a late-time solution which looks like a cosmological constant. It's not the same as a cosmological constant. The approach to this would be very different. You could ask all kinds of interesting cosmological questions about it. But before you do so, if you just put that solution, those equations simply on the computer, you'll find out that they're unstable. So that solution is unstable. So it's not what you really care about when you talk about cosmic acceleration. It's unstable with a time scale mu inverse, which I'll be setting to be about the Hubble time. So what's going on here? Well, in the case of FFR theories, it's very easy to see what's going on. You can perform a conformal transformation like this to a tilde frame where the entire theory is just scalar field coupled to gravity with extremely non-minimal couplings between scalar and matter fields. Okay, so let me just show that. So here's the theory you get in the Einstein frame. There's a Friedmann equation with a scalar field, regular scalar field, with a potential given entirely by that original function I wrote down. Okay? The energy density of matter, however, redshifts away in a different way than it normally would. There's this because of this coupling to the metric, the scalar degree of freedom, and hence there's another coupling term in the scalar field equation of motion too. Now, what's interesting about this theory is here you can see exactly why it's unstable. This is that De Sitter solution I identified on the previous slide, and it's unstable. Now here, if it rolls off this way, you'll hit a curvature singularity immediately. But what's interesting, if you roll down here, is that this is just an exponential potential. You can solve exactly for what happens. And what you find is that it rolls down, and asymptotically, the scale factor, and this is the scale factor in the original frame, I should say, behaves like A of t equals like t squared. It's an accelerating solution. If you interpreted this as quintessence, it would have an effective equation state parameter W is minus 2/3. Now, in a sense, this is very nice. You modified the Einstein equation, the Einstein action. You ended up with something that gave you a late-time accelerating solution, and many of the features that you used to have in quintessence are actually here. But it turns out this is a very different theory. It's a different theory because of that coupling between matter and the scalar field that you have no control of, otherwise. The coupling between matter and the scalar field is dictated by the fact that this theory has just a general form F of R. So let me, before I get into that, let me just comment. You'll notice that this value is at odds with what I told you was allowed by the data. Don't worry about that too much. If I just restored my 1 over n, then I can get pretty much any effective equation state parameter I like. Okay, certainly as close to minus 1 as I want. So this is a purely phenomenological model that you can write down, modifies gravity, and gives you late-time acceleration that easily fits the expansion history of the universe and the late-time acceleration. So nothing wrong with that. On the other hand, it's hideous in the solar system. It's hideous in the solar system because of that scalar degree of freedom, that gravitational strength, scalar degree of freedom coupled to matter. One way to see that is to map this theory via a different conformal transformation to a Branz-Dickey theory where omega is actually zero. That's generically true in these models too. There's a potential here, but that potential is very weak. It's irrelevant in the solar system. So that's how you see that W greater than 40, omega greater than 40,000 rules out this model. Said a different way, the fact that this theory looks like 1 over R means that in the solar system, which is described to a high accuracy by the Schwarzschild metric, and R is therefore very close to zero, you end up with problems. Like,
but in the solar system test, you're using, you have a particular metric, and you're using that planet satisfied JNS equations and so forth.
Yeah.
Are you free to choose an arbitrary rescaling? Because under some rescaling of the metric, the planet's no longer satisfied JNS equations.
You certainly have to make sure that you're doing that right. It's not just this. This is,
yeah.
Right, so this is just a way to see that it's, you have to do that correctly. No, that's right. Yeah, you're not, absolutely not free to just blindly map it around and say it works. For example, if I had just done that when I asked about cosmic exploration, I would never have seen this problem. I would have said it maps to a frame and it's just quintessence. No, you certainly have to do that. Nevertheless, this is spectacularly rolled out there.
Okay.
However, what you said does allow a couple of loopholes. And this, for example, if you were to introduce a function that is sufficiently complicated, such that it has several scales, such that on cosmological scales, the field is free to roll, and in the solar system, you allow that other scale to confine it, then you could get around this. But it's not easy. So that's a crucial thing. That's what I meant here when I said. OK, so this is a problem with these models. By the way, if you do something like this, that as soon as you say you have an idea that modifies general relativity, you can instantly become famous. You go in Nature, science journalists write about you, your collaborators get pictured in fancy ways behind transparent versions of your equations. And then when you know that you've made it when you make it into the modern day version of PRL, the New York Times. And so we were in this list of, you know, the 20 biggest problems faced in science, and one of them was number 5. 5 is pretty good. What is gravity really? And they talked about our work in here. We were really proud of this until we looked to number 6, which was, will we ever find Atlantis? This, you do not keep the greatest company when you start messing around. This was written by John Noble. Okay. Right. More seriously, if you took that last model and you took the attitude, okay, you're asking a lot to write down a theory of gravity that explains everything when you just started playing with it. Suppose that there were a way to cure solar system constraints by doing something sufficiently complicated. Now, could you just ask the question, what happens to cosmology in this problem? I've already told you what happens to the simplest thing, the expansion history of the universe. What about the details of cosmology? So one thing we did recently with my collaborators at Cornell, Rachel Bean and David Bernan, my former postdoc at Laurent Boghossian, and my current graduate student, Alessandro Silvestri, was to study in detail linear perturbation theory in these FFR models. And I just want to show you a couple of examples here, because there's kind of an interesting generic thing that happens in these models, which is that if you arrange to mimic the expansion history of the universe accurately so that you get late time acceleration, and you then figure out what the linear power spectrum is, which I'm plotting here, which OK, you find, so here's a couple of different models. One's the one I told you about. And f of r here is a different definition of f of r. You add an r to each of these, and you'll be fine. So there's two different forms here, but I don't really care what the forms are. The point is there's just two of them that work on those large scales. Then what you see is that if you fit to small scale matter power spectrum, you generically get cannot simultaneously get an agreement with the large scale and the small scale data. So all these models, so what you're seeing here is lambda CBM is the black line. That works pretty well. Okay? Then the red dashed lines are the different models in each case, normalized in different ways. Okay? But in either way, even if you fit to the small scale data, you dramatically miss the large scales. Okay? In particular, the CMB, which is not actually written on this graph. So there seems to be a generic problem here, even with this as a general model for large scale modifications of gravity, that if you look at the detailed perturbation theory, and I have the equations on slides that I'm not going to include in the talk, but if you want to look at them later, you can look at them. They're not fun, which is why you have a small grad student doing the calculations. Then it doesn't work on these scales. Raphael, you're interested.
So you just assume a power spectrum for primordial fluctuations, or
we're taking the inflationary power spectrum, right here, absolutely. But the primordial power spectrum is just vanilla Harrison's envelope. Yeah, you could legitimately ask the question: could you play around with this and see what?
But you might deduce that there has to be a different primordial spectrum.
You might, but you might also then. Okay, it would be a different question because then I'd also have to change my lambda CBM plot on here. So the point is that since lambda CBM with that assumption works well, how do these things fare with the same assumption? Okay. Now, in passing, I'd like to mention the following. Once you start playing around with ugly, weird actions, you can go as far as you like. So here's something you could do. You could introduce other curvature invariants. So here's just a specific example. Use these two curvature invariants and put them together in some inverse form like this, again, because I don't want to have Minkowski basis like times. And what's interesting about this in passing is two things. One, you can completely evade the solar system test. It's not a problem. As long as you have a non-zero coefficient of the Riemann tensor squared, you're OK. And the reason you're OK is that the Riemann tensor squared, well, the Weyl tensor squared part of it, is big in the solar system. And therefore, it suppresses that extra term. So this is fine, solar system. On the other hand, these theories generically have ghosts. Okay? They generically have ghosts. There have been a set of papers that have addressed this in various degrees of detail. Navarro and Van Aquilion showed that if you expand around the unstable, the Sitter solution that I talked about earlier, then there are no ghosts if you choose something that resembles the Gauss-Bonnet term here. But typically, if you expand around the accelerating attractor at late times in these models, which there typically is one, you find out there are either ghosts or superluminally propagating modes.
Yeah. So without a cosmological constant, all these theories and many, many more with propagating torsion, non-metricity, and so forth, were studied in the mid-70s to mid-80s, and were all found to have ghosts.
Yeah.
Why should the result change when you add a cosmological constant? Why would anybody have hoped it would change?
We're not adding a cosmological constant, first.
If the linearized analysis had already been done and they all had ghosts around flat space, why should it be any different around a slightly curved space? In other words, didn't we already know this?
I'm not sure that's true. I mean, no one would pitch this as this action is the action of everything. The question is, what is the generic effect of terms like this? We know for a fact there are examples where you can sum infinite series of corrections that do away with the case. String theory does that, for example.
Sure.
So I agree.
It was already understood that the modifications of the linearized propagator for any such corrections all have rules. It was already understood. And I don't mind that people felt constrained to check it again, but why did they think that it would be any different?
I don't know why it should be different around one of these late-time accelerating effects, but I'm not sure I understand why it has to be the same answer. And in fact, in this case, for the example I gave here, if you expand around the late-time accelerating effect, you actually can invent for certain tricks of parameters of just superluminal modes, no ghosts, which is, you know, weird in its own way, something I wasn't aware of before.
So is there even easy for which is Gauss-Bonnet?
It's a version of the Gauss-Bonnet. It's the important part of the Gauss-Bonnet.
Well, it's surprising because even Einstein knew that the reason he excluded anything other than R is because he knew that it would lead to superluminal propagation. So this was known in 1914.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that. Actually, one thing is you actually have to show that these modes can lead to information transfer faster. Can lead to information transfer. It's not clear that they can. This is a problem that various people have been talking about recently in different contexts.
Do with chaos, propagation. You don't mean. Do you mean that there's a breakdown of the fact that initial data determines everything within its domain of dependence? Or do you just mean there are modes that formally have a space-like formal name?
I mean that.
Because that thing, I mean, even just a scalar field with the wrong side of the mass squared has that. But it certainly doesn't have superluminal propagation in physical sense. You can't transmit it with your hand. You explain the tachyons when you say superluminal.
Well, I'm not sure they're tachyon. Let me talk to you later about that. I'm worse than that, I think. It's worse than that.
Okay, one other question.
Yeah.
Just that Brown expanding about the Sitter, you say there's no ghost and no superluminal propagation, whatever superluminal propagation.
Yeah, right. Actually, I want to skip this slide. It's not supposed to be there. Okay. So let me kind of conclude this part by pointing out something that's not really modified gravity, which I just think is interesting. So I've been showing that when you modify the action at all, you typically introduce new degrees of freedom. Those new degrees of freedom, while doing good things for you, can give you problems. So one question you could ask is there any way to modify the equations of relativity in such a way that you introduce new phenomena, but no new degrees of freedom? In other words, can you modify the constraint equations of general relativity without modifying the dynamics? So this is supposed to be schematic, by the way. I'll show you what I mean in a moment. So it's tricky to achieve this in general, but it turns out you can write down something, a trick to do it, which would be the following. Take a theory like this, which is, so all I've done here is I've chosen to write down a theory in the Brans-Dickey frame. And I've chosen a kinetic term, which means that it's not a propagating degree of freedom. And I've done this just to show where you can start to get to write down an answer. So the matter moves along G does to G mu nu. It's perfectly, matter is minimally coupled in this frame. But there's this weird scalar degree of freedom, but the scalar degree of freedom is not really there. So said differently, this choice of the value for the kinetic term in this theory is equivalent to choosing in the Einstein frame the no kinetic term whatsoever. Okay? So now ask, but I've written it down in this frame because this is the frame where matter falls along the geodesic. So now if you write down the equations of motion of this theory, you get a perfectly well-behaved Einstein gravity with no new degrees of freedom, but this field psi is determined, and it's not really a field, it's determined entirely by the matter density. It's actually determined by the trace of the angular momentum tensor, but I'm treating my matter here as just pressureless dust. So it's determined by rho via this equation. So this is the Friedmann equation now. It looks extremely complicated, but what it really is just a function of rho. But it's a function of rho, so it's a modified Friedmann equation in a theory that I know how to calculate anything I want to calculate. I can ask questions about gravitational waves, I can ask questions about the black hole, I can ask any questions. I'm not just writing down a modified Friedmann equation, I have a Lagrangian to work with. So the theory like this has a time-dependent Newton's constant and certain other environmentally determined factors where this doesn't mean anthropic, it just means it depends on your local energy density. And the point here is just that in a theory like this, which we call modified source gravity, the point is here just to explore what kind of equations can emerge from allowing yourself to play with different actions, then you can arrange choices of this potential U to have late time acceleration and everything else about your theory work out fine, because you choose U at early time in the universe to be irrelevant. So what's the point? The point is, within this Friedmann equation, it's trivial, pretty trivial, to reproduce the expansion history of the universe that you want, including acceleration. It's trivial to be safe in the solar system. It's trivial to have gravitational waves work well. There are no ghosts. There are, in fact, no new degrees of freedom. So what happens in a theory like this, but it's not GR. So then the point of playing with theories like this is not to have your own crazy theory that can mimic the expansion history of the universe. The point is to have a model that answers the question of why the universe is accelerating and then to make predictions that you can go test. And so again, you'd like to look at structure formation in this model. So if you do that...
Where do you put the scale of the present energy density in this theory?
I'm not sure what you... I mean, this omega matter is given by measurements. So you have no freedom there. But I do have an extra degree of freedom is the wrong word, an extra parameter in the theory that appears in the potential that I can choose. So the only matter in this theory is rho. So omega matter is 0.3 in this theory. And that's all there is. It's not a scalar field. It's a fake. It's just there to allow me to write down a modified Friedmann equation in a way that
When you make variation, you restrict to psi.
Then
you get second order differential equation for psi.
If you take that and you put it together with the Einstein equation, you will find that psi does not propagate.
It's because of the special choice of the coefficient.
That's right.
There.
Yes.
That's three or something like that. What will happen with this theory if you make a formal transformation to a Einstein equation?
There will be no kinetic term.
So how does the Einstein equation itself, not Friedmann,
I can, let me show you like, I mean, I have it written down, it's not on the slide though. It's,
so what does the act look like in the Einstein frame?
It'll be m Planck squared over 2r plus minus some complicated potential. But that's not where all the action is. All the action is in S matter coupled in some remarkably hideous way to coupling between the metric and the Kaifa. Something that you would never have written down just by sitting there and thinking, but this just is a trick that allows you to write it down. That's the point. So there's nothing deep, I should say, about writing this action. It's just a trick to allow you to write down a theory that gives you a modified theory.
But you can think just F as a function of rho in the action. Is a function of energy density, or no? Complicated function, because if you go to essentially the psi, or how to call this field, becomes Lagrangian multiplier, right? Because your energy is constrained, you will be psi minus
psi. In principle, you can just substitute back in for psi.
You can resolve, express psi through rho, substitute it there, then everything is done. Yeah.
Right. So that's absolutely the unit, but again, it's a very special form, right? And now you can ask any question about the theory you want to ask. So it's not just like writing down a modified theory, the reason it's trivial to reproduce the expansion history is that for that question, it does reduce to a modified Friedman equation, but then there are other things you can ask. So for example, if you just write down a modified Friedman equation, you can't declare perfection theory at all. But this you can. So what do you get? So this is just an example of the kind of things you get. So let me just focus on one of these graphs. It's the top one. So this is the power spectrum as a function of redshift. So delta by d log a, or if you care, I guess I'll show you, but this is the power spectrum against k for a particular model. So lambda CDM is this line here. Lambda CDM is this line here. And the only point I want to make with this picture is that something rather dramatic happens in this model. Once you've chosen your parameters to fit late-time acceleration, modes grow compared to lambda CDM. So again, this is another example of something where you actually have to do something very complicated to get a modification of your gravity equations to explain late-time acceleration. You can do it. You can get the expansion history to work. But then the details immediately turn out to have problems. Now, there is a very small loophole in this, I should point out, which is that, remember that my Friedman equation involves a function of rho. And I've chosen the way that works so that at early times in the universe, everything behaves well. So said a different way, when rho is big, things look like gr. When rho is low, they change. You get acceleration. Now, this is linear perturbation theory. So rho grows when these modes grow. Once they go nonlinear, in principle, you should return to GR. Whether that happens in such a way to allow this to be OK with data, I don't know. It would require a nonlinear simulation. I actually think it would be unlikely, actually. But it's worth pointing out that that's a loophole. But again, just an example, as I said, I was going to be showing some of the problems that one encounters trying to make modified gravity work for cosmic acceleration. And this is another example where you've got a great lens to make the background cosmology work and to make it consistent in every other way. And again, we hit a problem with structure formation that seems to be quite generic. What you'd really like, I assume you've seen this many times in colloquia too, what you'd really like is a cosmological version of what's happened recently for dark matter. Okay? So in dark matter, in the question of dark matter in the universe, you know that people have been pretty sure that dark matter was around for a very long time. On the other hand, there is a legitimate suggestion that maybe what you're seeing on the scale of galaxies and clusters is a modification of general relativity. There are a lot of proposals in which that is supposed to work. And what we really see, what you'd really like, is a smoking gun, something that seems to separate off the geometry from the particulate matter in the universe. And in dark matter recently, we've had something that seems to do that quite strongly, namely this thing called the bulk cluster, where if you've seen this, I apologize for boring you. If you haven't, it's incredibly cool. So this is a small cluster of galaxies that has recently punched through a larger cluster. And the important things to realize about this picture is that in galaxy clusters, By far, most of the baryons are in intergalactic dust. They're not inside the galaxies. And so they collide. And what happens if dark matter is right is that the baryons get slowed down in the middle by the collision. They collide and they heat up. Meanwhile, the dark matter doesn't feel anything except gravity, just goes on through. And so if you could find a way to figure out where most of the mass is and compare that to where most of the baryons is, you could figure out whether it's most of the mass is centered on the baryons, and what you know you have is a modification of gravity. The Lensing signature is focused where the mass is, or whether it's outside. And so people were able to do this using combinations of the Hubble Space Telescope to get the Lensing data and the Chandra X-ray telescope to get the glowing gas. And what you see here is the glowing gas in the middle, which has been slowed down, even a shock wave, which is kind of amazing, by the collision. And then out here is where the Lensing signals are focused, where the dark matter has gone straight through. So this is rather strong indication that dark matter is particulate instead of a modification of gravity. There are loopholes in this, as in anything, but this is very strong evidence. And we'd really love to have something like this for the same question with cosmic acceleration, but I think we're still struggling for it. Although what I've tried to show you in the last few examples is that combinations of structure formation in the microwave background do seem to provide us with some way to distinguish between different proposals. So the point I've been trying to make is that cosmic acceleration is definitely telling us something fundamental about physics. This is not news to anyone. It might well be that there are new energy sources out there, dark energy, chaos, and something like this. It may be that we've not properly understood how matter and space-time affect each other. Maybe there's a sensible way to understand the size of a cosmological constant that is small. Maybe there's a back reaction effect that we don't know. Okay? And it may be that some features of the universe are environmentally selected. Maybe there's an anthropic reason. I don't have a deep hatred of the anthropic. Actually, that's not true. I have a deep hatred of the anthropic principle. But I think it is a perfectly possible way for the universe to work, because it's perfectly possible. But I hope it's not true. I really do hate the anthropic principle. But it may be that that's what's going on. On the other hand, it might be that gravity is telling us on cosmological scales, cosmic acceleration is telling us on cosmological scales, gravity is different from GR. We don't know. There are a lot of interesting ideas, and the only way to tell is to try to figure out whether these smoking gun features, our best chances seem to be cross correlations of large scale structure, microwave background, geometric versus growth factors in the universe. So there's a lot of people working hard on this, and we're just one of the groups. So. That's the overriding question. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm all in favor of this kind of work, modifying playing around modifications of gravity, but if I were someone who understood effective field theory better, or someone who advocated that, I might make the following argument. I wonder how you would respond. You can, as you pointed out, you can make an infinite number of variations of gravity. But this effective field theory supposedly tells us that we should expect to see only certain kinds, and we should expect to see more or less holomorphic functions expanded to powers of the fundamental scale. The first term would be the cosmological constant, which for reasons of making life interesting, you've just set zero. But then the other terms wouldn't particularly look, I suppose, by this argument, like the kind of thing modifications you discussed. So how would you respond to that kind of argument, that the kind of terms you would expect to see are very effective fields are very different from the ones that you've been presupposing?
I think there's nothing wrong with making the point. But the truth is that the kinds of terms that you would expect from effective field theory will not give you like time cosmic acceleration. So we're faced with an incredibly difficult problem, namely the universe is accelerating. And I think it's incumbent on us to try, all the different approaches that can explain that fact and ask how we can observationally distinguish them from one another. So I agree with what you just said, but on the other hand, by the way, I think I was incredibly clear about this, but none of the examples I showed down are supposed to be me pitching to you how I think the world works. But the point is to ask the question, how might gravity be modified and how could you test it, is the only question we seek to answer here. So to make a comparison with something else, if when you're writing on dark energy models, I think it is incredibly important to try to connect those models to particle physics, to our understanding of fundamental particle physics. But to start with, we need to understand what kinds of modifications of what kind of things you can write down that give you acceleration, and then figure out how to connect them to particle physics. I have a similar feeling about the graphics.
So basically, you're saying, well, effective fields there seem to show this, but we don't know that it's telling us the whole story.
Yeah.
It might be something beyond.
Right.
And if there is something, it seems to me one crucial thing might be non-locality. So I felt for a while that one should look at the cosmological consciousness tied up with non-local physics.
Right.
So in that spirit, are people looking at models, I mean, how seriously are people looking at models where non-locality is put in? All the things you showed us, the local modifications.
I might not be the best person to ask about that. I think people, there are people who are looking at things like that, but there are many of them, and I'm not very familiar with that work. So I have nothing nothing meaningful to say, but it sounds like a reasonable thing to look at. Again, in the spirit that we don't understand something fundamental here, we should try all those questions on. I mean, what would be fascinating is to take something like this. If you can explain cosmic acceleration theory, then you have one anchor which constrains all the things you could do to a theory that are non-local, and then ask what else it predicts. That's what I find interesting about this approach. That's good luck.
Yeah, so the cluster is good evidence for dark matters against Mond, but how do you react to the problem named Mond is not a theory, et cetera, it has all these problems, it has, the transterrelative device, it all has its abilities. But there is still a basic observation of Milgram that there's an acceleration scale which is there in the Tully-Fisher relation and there in the rotation curves, measurable empirically. And that scale, which is empirically measurable in the galaxy data, is close to the dark energy scale. Don't you think that's a hint, even about something?
I think it might be. I mean, I have no problem with attempts to link those two things. In fact, I think it's a good idea. But as you say, so far people have problems. But that's right. One thing to say, though, is that, okay, there's many different things to say about this. But in the case of dark matter, we do have some fairly good, very good, I would say, ideas about where dark matter should come from that link it to our understanding of fundamental physics and that lead us to think that it should be particular. So just for an example...
Sure. But then where in the world is this? You can read off this scale A0 from the Tully-Fisher relation.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
I don't
know.
From
somebody's version of dark matter.
I don't know. On the other hand, it is also true that Mond, it does do a remarkable job with rotation curves. But not all of them. Some that it absolutely does not fit.
I mean, I'm convinced that Mond is wrong and something is right about dark matter, but the fact that c squared times the square root of lambda is there in the data, the observational data, at galactic scales.
It's fascinating, I agree. And I think, people are working on this, and maybe something will come of it. I'm not personally working on it, but I think it's interesting. I in no way mean to suggest that it's not something worthwhile working on. And also, dark matter, there are good arguments for dark matter, but it doesn't mean they're right. But I don't know. And also the fact that this acceleration scale does fail dramatically on some galaxy clusters, some galaxies, I that worries me, actually. And again, Mond, as you say, as an idea on its own, just as a modification to Newton's laws, fails on its own, meaning it doesn't give you any of the lensing results. Now, if you relativize it, then, as you say, relativisticize it, or whatever the right phrase is, then you will reproduce lensing almost automatically, right? But then, lensing of spherically symmetric bodies. But then, as you say, these theories will then seem to have couple problems. So I think it's interesting, but I don't have anything deep to say about it. I mean, tonight it's everyone notices this connection. Everyone's fascinated by it. Every conference you go to, several people give talks trying to connect them. It's good that there are different people trying lots of these different things. I have no idea what the answer is.
Let me ask a question related to Raphael's, because he was asking about effective field theories and a lot of the rationale for effective field theories is that it's a context in which you can quantify the size of the quantum correction for classical approximation. And the analysis, and of course, the whole the cosmological quantum problem is you don't see it until you do a quantum calculation. So to what extent have these models that you're looking at, have they been explored, and to what extent quantum effects change the prediction?
No. I mean, this is a progress report, right? So this is where we are with these various models.
Is there another question? Does this take Mark in? Or